From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Noe Valley, San Francisco.
DuBose Triangle, Lower Haight.
Visitation Valley.
Downtown San Francisco.
Oh, Ingleside, SF.
Coming up, a chilling new report results in the pulling of federal funds from a local home for people with disabilities.
There's patterns here that a police force inside a developmental center should be catching and isn't.
Then we'll take you on the number one bus through Oakland, where you can never tell what someone's got in their bag.
Ride that one. You'll find out. Ride that one. You find out what's in the bag.
And what's the view like from the bus driver's perspective?
Nobody's going to take me out of my element and make me like, oh, it's a messed up day.
Get on the bus. That and more today on Cross Currents. Stay tuned. We start today in Sonoma County. The California Department of Health has issued a scathing report about a board and care home for people with disabilities. It's the Sonoma Developmental Center, which houses about 500 patients in the city of Eldridge. California Watch obtained a copy of the nearly 500-page document, which details numerous citations of neglect and abuse by staff, as well as lack of action on these cases by on-site law enforcement. According to the report, the center will lose its federal certification and funding if it doesn't upgrade its patient care immediately. Ryan Gabrielson of California Watch reported on the situation this morning. He joins me now via Skype. So what kind of abuses did they find were going on?
In September, someone used a stun gun on a dozen patients at the Sonoma Developmental Center. The police force in-house at the Developmental Center received a tip that it had been a caregiver that had been doing this. They find the police search the caregiver's car the next morning and find a taser in there. And they don't make an arrest. They never actually made an arrest for the assaults on 12 patients. So it's that kind of assault. There's, you know, some of the typical hitting, shoving type of things.
How long had this been going on?
When we're talking about the developmentally disabled, abuse is endemic. So it's really these facilities are judged on what steps they take to try to prevent it and how they respond to abuse. And the response to abuse has been one of the most troubling things, is they have this in-house police force called the Office of Protective Services that exists solely to respond to these types of cases. And yet, time and again, our reporting has found, and now the Department of Public Health has documented really incomplete investigations where the leads aren't followed. You know, they'll find evidence that suggests, possible sexual abuse, injuries and bruises on, breasts and genitals, and they don't investigate that as possible sex abuse. There was a case in May in which a caregiver was found having exposed himself in a bathroom to a female patient. Now, the Sonoma County Sheriff's Office in that case was called in. He was arrested and recently pleaded no contest and is now serving 8 months in prison. But what we didn't know initially was that there's a second victim in that case, and that though these two women are roommates, and they had previously suffered injuries suggestive of this kind of abuse, and that this caregiver had been working on those working shifts before those injuries were discovered. There's patterns here that a police force inside a developmental center should be catching and isn't.
Well, I guess the penalty would cut off the money, the reimbursements that cover, according to your report, about half of the center's $160 million annual budget. And the report's telling them, that they need to immediately upgrade patient care. What does that mean? What improvements would need to be made to save that funding? And is there a timeline for it given?
They basically have to undertake a wholesale reform of a lot of their operations and training for how to, do some stuff that they have to encounter a lot, like placing feeding tubes was one of the things that they're apparently deficient in, assessing vital signs and pain management for patients on the medical side. On the abuse side, they've got to overhaul that police force. They've received very minimal training in how to do criminal investigations. They have a long history of failing to collect evidence or even recognize when a crime has been committed. So they've got to show that they can respond to cases of abuse and implement steps to prevent it.
Some of these stories are just really difficult to read about and to hear about. So what kind of legislation is on the table to deal with this?
There are two bills right now, Senate bills 1522 and 1051. And they are trying to accomplish the same thing in slightly different ways. 1051 requires reporting of many serious incidents, serious injuries, suspicious deaths and the like, to not only outside police, but to a disability rights protection and advocacy group who can also have investigate.
And that's in front of Jerry Brown right now, the governor?
That just passed the assembly yesterday, and it's already passed the Senate. So now it's to the governor's office. The other part of that the legislation would, for the first time, create minimum qualifications for someone to be the chief of this internal police force at developmental centers. In the past, they've hired non-police officers, bureaucrats from within the Department of Developmental Services with no law enforcement experience to run the force. So that would theoretically prevent that. The other bill, 1522, would require immediate notification of outside law enforcement in cases of patient death.
And that didn't happen? When I read that, I was curious. The SB 1522, sponsored by Leno, that didn't already happen in case of patient death or sexual abuse or assault with a deadly weapon? They didn't used to call law enforcement immediately? What did they do?
Well, no, they didn't. Not outside law enforcement, not reliably, not in a lot of cases. They didn't. They would notify coroner's offices, which are oftentimes in California attached to sheriff's departments. But when they submitted those reports, if they weren't notified, it wasn't as a potentially criminal matter.
What has the Sonoma said in response to this report so far, if anything? Is it defending itself? Is it saying, yes, we did it?
Yes, they're saying we are going to fix ourselves. I mean, this is in terms of the police force, it's statewide. There are five developmental centers across California, and they all have this Office of Protective Services handling criminal investigations there. In most cases, rather than outside police, and they have agreed that they need to across the board upgrade the force.
And if they don't, they lose the money. Any talk about where funding might come in that case?
In the case of the Sonoma Center, if they lose the federal reimbursement through Medicaid, it comes from California taxpayers. They can't stop caring for the severely developmentally disabled at Sonoma.
So taxpayers are going to end up paying.
If the Sonoma Center can't keep up its end and fix its many problems, that's what would happen.
Ryan Gabrielson reports for California Watch. We have a link to his article and to the Department of Health's report on the Sonoma Center at KALW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Now we'll go south from Sonoma to the East Bay. One way to get to know a new place is to ride public transportation, especially the bus. It's like taking an unguided tour, a tour where there's often as much to see inside as there is outside the windows.
Approaching 11th and Harrison.
The most popular buses in Oakland are the 1 and the 1R. The 1, which is the local route, makes 105 stops in three different East Bay cities. It's a trip that takes 4 hours from start to finish. More than 22,000 people ride these bus routes every single day. Most don't own cars. This is the only way they get around. The buses travel right through the heart of the Fruitvale and San Antonio neighborhoods along International Boulevard, also known as
East 14th, man. It's the main drag of Oakland. They changed it over to International. I like International, too, but it's East 14th.
Whatever you call it, it's a road and a part of Oakland with an identity all its own. KALW's Julie Kane took a ride on the 1 and came back with this report.
Have fun on the 1. Look, that's just what I'm gonna say too. Bye.
When I first got to Fruitvale, I asked a woman outside the BART station where to catch the bus. She looked me up and down slowly.
The one over here is on this side, and that goes to East Oakland. Uh-huh. You don't want to go over there.
The one bus has a reputation, just like the East Oakland neighborhoods it runs through. You never know what might happen. The day can turn from peaceful to deadly without warning. Crime is high, and people are poor. But today, the streets of Fruitvale and San Antonio are vibrant and full of life. Ice cream vendors' bells blend with hip-hop pulsing from passing cars, and Mexican ballads seep out of the doors of dark neighborhood cantinas. The people speak many languages, Vietnamese and Spanish, Chinese and English. People tend to keep to themselves on the streets, but on the bus, everybody comes together.
Anybody behind you?
No, I said.
At the front of the bus, an elderly lady sits with a tight grip on her purple shopping cart. A woman speaking Spanish to her kids wrangles grocery bags and a stroller towards the middle section, where there are more empty seats. Towards the back, young men slouch low, listening to music and looking out the windows.
What? 10 more cents. One more dime. It's right there in front of you on the fare box.
Robert Hawkins is behind the wheel.
It's like a switch turns on in your head because you know that you're getting ready to deal with a bunch of mess, or the potential for a bunch of mess out here. You got a question? Oh, okay. I thought you said excuse me.
Hawkins has been driving the number one bus for 5 years. Drivers with more seniority tend to avoid this route, but he knows it.
No, I actually used to live in the Fruitvale area in the 20s. Basically, I was raised by the street. I recognize things that an ordinary person on the bus is not going to recognize when I'm driving through those neighborhoods. So when I'm driving, I just try to focus on what I'm doing and nothing else. Answer people's questions if they have them. And just try to make it through the day as peacefully as possible.
The woman with the grocery bags is named Rosa Lopez. She takes the one every day.
To my appointments, to school, to my immigration in San Francisco. You know, it takes you where you have to go and it's cheap.
Lopez also grew up in the neighborhood, and she says it doesn't really deserve its reputation.
Everybody's out here, you know, friendly. If you're friendly to them, they're going to be friendly to you.
One of her daughters reaches up and pushes the button for their stop. And Lopez gathers their things and shepherds the little girls out the back door.
Come on, this way.
Out the windows of the bus, the signs are in Vietnamese, Lao, Spanish, and English. We pass by all kinds of mom-and-pop businesses, restaurants, flower shops, Western wear stores, a beauty parlor. A storefront church with a hand-lettered sign butts up against a deli advertising burritos and Vietnamese banh mi sandwiches. I get off the bus for a few minutes at 29th and International. A Vietnamese man named Dune is at the bus stop sitting in the sun. He lives in San Antonio, the neighborhood west of Fruitvale called Little Vietnam, and he's on his way home.
How much longer till it comes, do you know?
Well, now it's, I think, about 10 more minutes.
Do you like it here?
No. The neighborhood is, they're not safety. But the house pricing is cheap. To get all the poor people in the neighborhood.
It's not safe, he says, but the housing is cheap, so it's just poor people living in the neighborhood. Behind him, in the shade of an awning, a woman is crocheting a bright pink baby sweater. Her name's Lori Greenway, and she's not waiting for the bus. She lives on a fixed income and sits here most days, hoping someone will stop to buy something she's made.
And they've gotten used to seeing my smiling face, you know. And
So a lot of the ice cream vendors, fruit vendors, even just people that I see on a regular basis, if I'm not where they're used to seeing me for a couple of days, it's like, what happened? Are you okay?
That tension, the worry if someone is okay, is in the air in the neighborhood. It always feels like something might happen.
One, Berkeley Bart.
In the same way, the one has a reputation for being a wild ride. I get back on, still expecting something crazy to happen. Towards the back of the bus is Addie Ortiz. She rides the one to and from school every day.
I remember this one time, we were riding the bus, and this little girl, she was sitting right by the door, and her mom came with like three other babies, and she was just standing there, and the little girl got off, and the door opened, and the mom was right there, and I didn't pay attention to her, and like 5 minutes later, we're like, excuse me, and she was just like on the phone, and then she was just like, where's my baby? We're like, we're trying to tell you your baby got off like 5 minutes ago right there. And she's like, oh my gosh, like get off, stop, my baby. That was just crazy to me. I was like laughing, like, oh my God, this lady. But yeah.
I hope it turned out.
Yeah, she got it. She just ran back. That was funny, but crazy. It was scary.
In the very back, a couple rows behind Ortiz, Julius Conley is looking out the windows.
You know, I got on here one time, and it was late at night, and this guy got on with, like, a duffel bag and started tripping and trying to make people get up out of their seats and trying to punk them and stuff. And he was just like, do you know what I got in this bag? Do you know? You don't know. Get up. He said, you don't know what I got. You don't know what's in this bag, you know, like this bag right here. And I was just sitting there like, damn, like, you don't know. I got a chopper. So that's what it's like. Yeah, you don't know what's in the bag. Ride that one. You'll find out. Ride that one. You'll find out what's in the bag, you know. So, right.
All right, well, take it easy.
Appreciate you talking
to me. Likewise.
All right.
Most everyone on the bus has some kind of story of how just when they thought they'd seen it all, something new and unbelievable happened. But on the day I rode the one, what I saw was something much more ordinary. Regular people traveling through the neighborhood, getting to work, to school, to the doctor, or just getting out of the house. In that way, the one is kind of like East Oakland itself. A place with a wild reputation that a lot of people call home. On the one in Oakland, I'm Julie Kane for Cross Currents.
Oh, ho, for the bus that rolls down the dirt road.
We'd like to hear your adventures on public transportation. Post on our Facebook page, KALW News, or tweet at us at KALW News.
More banana trees crowding the ground. Oh, ho, the Australian that dressed in red. Oh, ho, the Ferlinghetti beard on his head. Oh, ho, for the roar of the motor uphill.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. In the story you just heard, AC Transit driver Robert Hawkins described the beginning of his workday like this.
It's like a switch turns on in your head because you know that you're getting ready to deal with a bunch of mess or the potential for a bunch of mess out here.
In this next audio snapshot from our Hear Hear community storytelling team, fellow Oakland bus driver Archie Johnson shares the lessons he's learned from the road.
My name is Archie Johnson. I'm a driver for AC Transit 26 years.
1R,
it was this lady who got on my bus and she didn't like the way I was driving. She was trying to get to work early, but it was right in commute hour. So the bus was real packed, and she was talking about me behind my back. She was just saying, oh, this is the worst driver ever. He's the worst driver. She says, why don't you just drive faster? You drive like you got a stick up your butt. The next time I saw her, it was raining, and she was running for the bus, and she was nowhere near the stop, and she had her child with her. I waited for like a minute for her and her child in the rain. And she looked up and she saw me, same driver. And I had a choice. I said, I could leave her. And in my mind, I really wanted to leave her. But in my heart, I said, nah, I'm going to pick her up. Then when she walked on, she realized it was me. Then she just gave me a look like, thank you. I gave her a look like, I'm the same guy. Sometimes it feels good to get revenge. But I didn't get it. But I felt good. That's probably one thing that I've learned. Nobody's going to take me out of my element and make me like, oh, it's a messed up day. Because, you know, the whole purpose is to get home each day and enjoy your home.
That was Oakland bus driver Archie Johnson. This story was produced by KALW's Wendy Baker as part of our new community storytelling initiative, Hear Here, a pop-up radio project. Our Hear Here team will be at the 81st Avenue East Oakland Library this Saturday recording your stories. To find out more, check out our website, kalw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. And now for some artery, cultural coverage that flies by the seat of its pants. Bus drivers work on routes that are well mapped out, kind of like artists. Most of them work with a design in mind. Architects have their blueprints, actors have their screenplays, a plan for how their project will proceed. But for improv comics, art is making people laugh without a script or even a clue of how to do it before hitting the stage. You might remember the TV program Whose Line Is It Anyway, where four comics get on stage with no script or plan whatsoever, take suggestions for skits from the audience, and see what happens.
The situation we'd like to improvise in is taking an animal to a vet. So if you just start off with no particular style, and then we'll cut him with...
I ran him over with a car... And I think he's sick. It used to be a dog, but it would be fine as a turtle now, owing to the fact it got run over.
Well, performer Ron West from the original British version of the show will be in town this weekend to teach an improv workshop as part of the San Francisco Improv Festival, which is running through this Sunday at San Francisco's Eureka Theater. The executive producer of the festival is Jamie Wright of the local improv group Crisis Hopkins. He swung by our studios and I asked him, what's the difference between sketch and improv?
Well, sketch, you know, it's, of course, it's written, and it's been worked over quite a bit by funny people, ideally. And improvisation is something which just comes off the top of the dome, like having people on stage, you know, and it can be dramatic as well. It can be, you know, comedic. It's a wide range of anything that you kind of make up given a sort of a basic inspiration, whether it's a title or a relationship or... place, anything like that. And sketch comedy oftentimes comes out of improvisation, or
it seems they're related.
It's true. You know, most I would say most companies that end up start as an improvisation company oftentimes end up doing sketch, and that is because improv is a great sort of training tool, and it sharpens your ability to understand what is funny and what timing is. And what elements go together to, you know, create the tension, which is humor. But definitely you see people who are writing sketch right now, like Tina Fey, a lot of the people on SNL, I worked with at Boom Chicago back in the day. And that is like all these people are improvisers, you know, Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, Will Ferrell, Seth Meyers, Jason Sudeikis. You know, I can go on for ages, like talking about like Steve Carell, you know.
You mentioned earlier, Whose Line Is It Anyway? And that might be kind of the way TV viewers were introduced to improvisation, where four players, you kind of did improv in front of an audience and they'd involve the audience as well. And I was wondering if you felt improv can be as effective on mass media like television or radio, as the intimacy of a theater?
Well, I would say there's something about the nature of improvisation that makes a translation a little bit difficult. The heart of improvisation is about being in the moment And you know, I know it sounds very kind of theater nerdy sort of business, but you end up sharing a happening with a group of people. Like, people in the audience are part of the show. People on stage are part of the show. The people on stage are getting inspiration and feedback from the people in the audience, and that directs, in a way, what organically just happens. You know, and it's what you bring to the, it's what everyone brings to the party. Like, the people walking in the door, like, throw out crazy suggestions, or they're like really like they got a little bit of a heat on, they're really ready to laugh, so the energy is really high, and that feeds the actors. Or it's a little more quiet and things go a little more slow, or maybe a little more thoughtfully. You know, it's a back and forth, and it's hard to capture that, I think, on video as a to hold as a, you know, or to package as a product or something like that. It's a lot, I think, a little more easy on radio, because I think people open up their imaginations a bit more on radio. Like, I it's a very unique medium.
Radio is better than TV. You know that, right?
It is a totally different experience, and it's a delightful experience.
Is it an easily acquired skill, or is it a talent you're born with? It would seem to me, just the person watching, that, you know, I can't do that.
There's a great teacher who is no longer with us. His name is Del Close, and he started back at the beginning of sort of modern improvisation, and taught and directed in San Francisco with a committee for years, and went on to start Improv Olympic with Cherna Halpern. And one of the things that he would always say is, don't tell jokes on stage. Don't ever tell a joke on stage. I don't want to see that. Like, you stand up, you be there, and you react honestly to what's happening. And, you know, there's that old line, you know, it's funny because it's true. That is sort of at the heart of what's great about improvisation, you know. And the thing is that people look at improvisation and think, oh, I could never do that. But the fact of the matter is, you're doing it every single day. Like, we're doing it right now. We're just having a conversation. Like, we didn't plan this. We didn't script this. We, you know, we said, hey, we're going to talk about improv.
It's not funny.
Well, not yet. Wait till they get done cutting it.
Uh-huh.
Now, you know, but the thing is, it's improvisation, and, you know, it's not always funny. But most of the time, it's just a fun situation, as long as people are comfortable in their own skin.
So since you mentioned we're sitting here and we're improvising, we do a little bit of that on the radio sometimes. Mm-hmm. We call it ad-libbing when there's no script and we just talk, right? So can we do it now? I don't know. Seth, can you give us like a topic, or how does this even work if we can just kind of just do improv right now?
Well, I think you could probably just start with a relationship or a place.
A place. Seth, give me a place.
How about Oakland?
Oakland? I mean, come on, man.
Well, a place is actually like a place two people might be.
A place two people might be.
Okay, fine. The desert.
The desert? We're in the desert. What else do we need?
Well, I think you just need to start by knowing that, like, it always helps when you know each other.
Okay. So there has to be a relationship.
Yeah.
Between the people in the place.
Yeah.
Okay, so you are, I am a thirsty person in the desert.
Well, you don't necessarily want to plan it out. Like, you just want to, like, know that when you come on, somehow, like, you know each other. And that's made obvious by the way that whoever initiates the scene just initiates it. And then all you do is you accept what the other person says, and you build on that.
And build on it. Okay, we're in the desert. You start.
All right. Baby, Mojave vacations are not all they're cracked up to be.
They honestly told me it was going to rain and it'll be nice and cool and nice.
It's 135 degrees out.
I know.
I'm wearing flip-flops and they're melting.
I know. I'm sorry. The next plane will be here in 45 minutes. We have 45 minutes. What are we going to do?
Levitate?
I wish. It's too hot. It's too hot to do anything.
Can you stand over me? I'm gonna get really small. You stand over.
See, that's not fair. That's just not fair. You stand over me.
You never try and help me out.
Oh, is this what it's about now?
This is what it was about when we started this trip. This is what it was about when we started our relationship.
And you're going to bring your mother into this, I'm sure, in 1 second. You're going to bring your mom into this. We're in the middle of the Mojave Desert, and here you are fighting, and you're going to bring your mother into this.
Well.
So predictable.
I'm carrying her with me in the backpack. I never leave home without her ashes. You know that.
Oh, no, you did not. You did not go the mother is dead route. Okay, so how was that?
I don't know.
Who knows, right?
People can call in and say.
But that's what it is?
Yeah, it's just, you're just making it up. And like, you know, like sometimes it's great and sometimes it's not great. And sometimes it's just kind of like there are moments when it's funny, but it's like, it's the kind of discovery of it, which is sort of fun. Like I carry my mother's ashes with me in my backpack.
I never saw that coming. Like, never.
I didn't either. I had no idea.
And there was a point where I was like quiet and trying to think like what next? But it just came.
Mm-hmm.
That's exciting.
Yeah, it's fun. And, you know, and like I said, it's what people do all the time, every day. Like you walk around, you go into the bakery and you like get your banana bread. Like, you know, I love banana bread. And people just kind of talk with you and you talk back and you have a laugh sometimes, or sometimes it's just like $2.75, thank you, you know, and that's it. But you know, it's just kind of it's a way to look at the world ultimately, as well as it's like good rules for life, like accept what's happening, bring something to the table, like build on things, take action.
The San Francisco Improv Festival is going on through this Sunday, August 26th. The executive producer of the festival is Jamie Wright of the local improv group Crisis Hopkins. Details are at kalw.org. That's it for today's edition of Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Julie Kane, Audrey Dilling, Emily Gaddick, Nina Gensler-Debs, Erica Moo, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Seth Samuel, Stephen Short, and Mariel Wallof. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Ben Refney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Thanks to City Car Share, which provides an alternative transportation option for our reporters. City Car CarShare is online at citycarshare.org. And thank you, we're listener-supported radio.
The Jester walked in the garden.
This is the voice of Kyle Alden. The San Francisco singer, songwriter, guitarist is known in some circles for setting the poetry of W.B. Yeats to music. His sound could probably be called Americana, but it's perhaps more accurate to refer to it as Californiana. Alden will be the musical host next Tuesday at the Bazaar Cafe in San Francisco. Music starts at 7 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.
But the young queen would not listen. She rose in her pale nightgown. She drew in the heavy casement and pushed the latches down. He bade his heart go out to her when the owls called out no more. In a red and quivering garment, it sang to her.